Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It's good to be talking with you today. I'm talking to you from Florida. I hope it's beautiful where you are. There are lots of things for us to talk about today, but I'll tell you, there's one focal issue we just have to talk about. The subway bombings yesterday, the terror strikes in Moscow, reminded us once again of the reality of global terrorism and of the reality of evil. And it seems that from time to time, this particular issue arises in the most unexpected way, where we're not surprised that the issue of evil arises. I'll tell you, I'm often surprised that people seem surprised by this. And so from time to time, what we have is this recurring question, what is evil? How do we know what evil is? Where does it come from? How do we explain it? Sergei Kanetsov, the Russian novelist of the novel Butterfly Skin, wrote in the New York Times today that evil exists and horror is always right beside you. And he writes from a tradition of Russian pessimistic philosophy and spirituality. It's indeed endemic and very well known in Russian literature. But today, the people of Russia are scratching their heads trying to figure out what's going on. Two suicide bombings conducted by females. This reminds the people in Russia of the spate of Black Widow suicide and terror bombings that took place earlier this decade. 38 people dead in the Moscow subway, two of the nation's most iconic subway stations targeted in attacks about 40 minutes apart, calculated to be when there would be maximum impact, the bombs laden with bolts and screws and other metallic objects, so there'd be maximum carnage. At least 38 people in the Moscow subway were killed yesterday, about 67 currently hospitalized. The photographs coming from Russia are frightening and just another reminder of what terror really does represent, what a terrorist strike really does look like. It is an effort to put terror in every single human heart within a civilization, and that's exactly what they're facing right now in Moscow. What we're looking at is the question of evil. Why is it that we're surprised by this? When I looked at this comment by Sergei Kanetsov in today's New York Times, it struck me, you know, Russians should be among those, given their own history, who expect this, at least in terms of the knowledge of evil. And yet, as Sergei Kanetsov wrote, it is so easily forgotten. You know, I'll tell you what, in a postmodern age, there are some people who deny that evil actually exists as anything that is objectively evil. We're looking at a time of moral confusion when many people aren't really sure that you can call anything or anyone or any act evil. Today we're going to be talking about the necessity of using this word when it's the only word that will apply. We're also going to be talking from a Christian perspective about why it is that this isn't just a spiritual, psychological, literary issue. This gets right, quite literally, to the human heart. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Folks, let's face it. There is an aspect, a dimension to this that has everything to do with the fact that these suicide bombers were women. And one of the things that I'm going to be tracing with you on the program today is kind of the rise or the recurrence of female suicide bombing. And it can certainly go back to the mid-1980s, but what we're looking at here is something that I think most people look at as a categorically evil context here with categorically evil acts, and it just leads to all kinds of questions. Many people right now are having children who are asking, what does this mean? They're looking at the pictures coming. It's kind of like what happens after every disaster, every attack, every terror strike. What do these things mean? This is the place to talk about it. And the way you join the conversation is by calling me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Always glad to hear from you by email. Write us at mail@albertmohler.com. And at Twitter, it's @AlbertMohler or Mohler Radio. Facebook, the Albert Mohler Program. We'll be talking about all this in just a moment. First of all, a review of some other issues in the news. Right here in the United States of America, 9 men were arrested, charged with being a part of a militia plot against the United States government. And this was to include bombing. As a matter of fact, this group that was arrested in Michigan was supposedly plotting attacks against U.S. law enforcement officers using the same kind of incendiary and explosive devices that were encountered by our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. And once again, while we look across at the images coming from Russia, it's a reminder to us that there are those who would do quite similar things, even far closer to us. And we'll be tracking that story with you. No doubt it's going to have an interesting time ahead. What you're looking at there is what is expected by many law enforcement officials to be the first in many arrests, as there appears to be a crackdown on some of these militia movements here in the United States. Interesting article in the New York Times that just really requires my attention. The headline is, "In Subway Ads on Abortion, a Pretense of Neutrality." The news coming out of Russia is about attacks, terror attacks in a subway. Here in the United States, this New York Times article is about a public relations campaign in the subway. AbortionChangesYou.com is the website that has the attention of Susan Domidus, writing the Big City column in the New York Times. She writes about this, saying that it's a relatively oblique message. She says, "A far cry from a brick in the window or a death threat to a member of Congress, a young woman pondering a difficult choice might check out the website, AbortionChangesYou.com, highlighted on the ad, which will lead her to the personal narrative of a woman troubled by her own abortion." Now, what's really interesting, as this reporter tries to track this out, she's obviously irritated that it's not just a neutral website, but it has a point of view on abortion. Now, the thing that I want to ask, honestly, to a reporter from the New York Times is how there could be neutrality in this. That's the one thing. All these decades into the abortion controversy in America, where in the world is there any sane suggestion that there could be a morally neutral way of approaching this question? She writes, "With some degree of outrage, or at least criticism, that when you actually look beneath this ad, you discover that it is linked to other sites that are clearly pro-life." She writes, "In the end, an abortion changed me campaign, that might be therapeutic, but abortion changes you. That sounds like propaganda masquerading as therapy." Well, it's not just therapy, it's a moral warning. And it's just another reminder to me that in a morally confused age, there are still people who are trying to say, let's try to come up with a morally neutral message, a morally neutral way to deal with something, which, after all, we're talking about here is the taking of innocent human life. There is no moral neutrality on something of that significance. Folks, just in terms of a sign of the times, two articles in one newspaper in just a matter of a couple of days about children at play, or for that matter, you might say children not at play. Mark Hyman, writing the box seats column in the New York Times on Sunday, writes about Sandlot Day, one day a year where some communities are letting kids actually organize their own play on the baseball field. And you have Mark Hyman saying, look, it's not a bad idea. A few generations ago, all youth baseball was more or less the sandlot varieties. Manicured fields were few and far between. Parents were not around to fill fungos or draw up lineups. Children were on their own to become proficient at sports and to love them. But it writes about the fact that that there are very few now child-organized games played by children anywhere. And they're now officiated over by an entire army of adults. David Elkind, writing in the New York Times in the day's edition before. So this is just one day before, in the op-ed section, has an article entitled "Playtime is Over." David Elkind's been one of these people watching childhood over the last several years who has warned us that we're not letting kids be kids. Now he's professor emeritus of child development at Tufts University, and he's written this article in the New York Times suggesting that we may now have children so alienated from play that they're going to have get this, recess coaches, just in order to know how to play. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, no kidding, has awarded $18 million to a group known as Playworks, a nonprofit training company that has placed coaches for recess at 170 schools in Boston and Los Angeles. David Elkind writes, children today are growing up in a world vastly different from the one their parents knew. No doubt about it. He writes also, for children in past years, participating in the culture of childhood was a socializing process. They learned to settle their own quarrels, to make and break their own rules, and to respect the rights of others. They learned that friends could be mean as well as kind, and that life is not always fair. Now that most children no longer participate in this free-form experience, playdates arranged by parents are no substitute. Their peer socialization has suffered. One tangible result of this lack of socialization, he says, is the increase in bullying, teasing, and discrimination in so many schools. It's very, very interesting. Children are meant to play. No doubt about it. They may be meant for other things as well, and certainly growing up and gaining responsibilities as they grow older. But when play is removed from childhood and children are treated just like little adults, and frankly, they're treated as if they are not competent even to organize their own play, well, it leaves them with far more deficiencies than just that of peer alignment. It's an interesting thing to ponder. Recess coaches. Necessary. That's millions of dollars by a foundation to put coaches in schools so that kids can be reminded, go through a relearning process of how to play. And then these communities forming Sandlot Day, where one day parents just step back and let the kids organize play themselves. Folks, we are living in a time in which many people are confused about childhood. But Christian parents ought to be the people who know that children are supposed to be children. That's why we are commanded to raise them in the nurture and admonition and in the discipline of the Lord. But there's nothing wrong and everything right with children learning how to play and with parents stepping back and letting kids do what kids should naturally know to do, and that is to play. We're going to come back to talk about evil in an age of moral relativism. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The images coming in from Moscow are frightening, but not all that surprising. Yesterday, two major terror attacks in the subway system there in Moscow. Moscow is a large city, of course, the capital of Russia, former capital of the Soviet Union. And Moscow is a city that thrives by its subway. Its subway system, going all the way back to the time of the early Soviet Union, was a matter of tremendous national pride. The two women, along with their female accomplices who led the terror attacks yesterday, targeted two of the most iconic stations in the Moscow subway system. And there they unleashed two suicide bombing attacks, killing at least 38 people, with another 67 hospitalized. Very interesting. The background of this, of course, there's the Chechen breakaway struggle. Chechen rebel leader Doku Umarov said last month about Moscow, quote, "If Russians think that war is happening only on television somewhere far off in the Caucasus and it will not touch them, then we are going to show them that this war will return to their homes," end quote. The Monday attacks were blamed on terror cells associated with Islamic insurgents in the Caucasus region, where anger against Moscow brews against groups, including a recently united Islamic front. Formerly, most of those terror attacks have been spawned in neighboring Chechnya, though Russian authorities downplay Chechenian involvement in this. Paul Quinn Judge, a specialist with the International Crisis Group, told the Wall Street Journal that the struggle in the Caucasus region had been transformed in recent years. Quote, "Go back even to the early 2000s, and this was still a war being fought for independence by an armed force that was in its majority secular. Now we have a religious war being fought for a caliphate." Now, the use of female suicide bombers is certainly a central part of this story. That is traced back to 1985, when a 16-year-old girl drove a truck filled with explosives into an Israeli army convoy. The New York Times reminded its readers that Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated in 1991 by a female member of the group known as Birds of Paradise, a group associated with the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka. Earlier this decade, female suicide bombers, known in Moscow as Black Widows, carried out at least 16 bombings in Russia, two of them on airliners. The specter of spreading terror attacks in the Russian capital, and a sense of shock and fear, and, of course, a lot of political speculation there. But it's the moral issue here that's of greatest importance to me. Sergei Kanatsov, whom I mentioned earlier, deeply moved by his own memory, reminded his own fellow Russians, evil exists and horror is always right beside you. He went on to say, "Tomorrow we will wake up and live with these truths, at least until we forget them again, as we have many times before." You know, when you start looking at this, you realize that all this postmodern reticence about using the word evil, all of this relativism, and just moral unease with making judgments comes to an end when you see something like this. It is a morally complex picture, no doubt, but it is not a morally complex question as to whether it is evil to plot this kind of vengeance against innocent noncombatants. The answer to that has to be that this is a deep and undeniable evil. Woe to the society that cannot declare that. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. How do we talk about this? Why is it that even in this age, in the year 2010, there are those who seem to still have the question as to whether there is such a thing as evil? Charles is calling from West Milton, Ohio. Listen on the World Wide Web. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I think if we're gonna stop it, we're gonna have to have the courage, and it's a horrible thing, but we're gonna have to have the courage of men like Winston Churchill, George Washington. You know, we're just going to have to do what we have to do to put an end to this, and we can't you know, we can't try to capture these people one at a time and send them to a place like Gitmo and feed them, you know, chicken and have workout routines for them.
You know, Charles, the issues you raise there demonstrate how difficult it is for a democratic society to respond even to something as challenging as terror. In the United States of America, there is still a sense of national unease with how to deal with this. A front page story in the New York Times also in recent days has to do with the fact that the Obama administration is itself very divided about how to deal with some of the most basic questions. Here I'm looking at the New York Times from March the 29th. That's Monday, just yesterday. Here's the headline, Obama team split on tactics against terror. And what makes that story interesting, of course, is that the split goes right down the issues that President Obama ran on when he was candidate Obama running for the office of president. Once you are inside the White House and bear that responsibility, the issues are not so easy to dismiss as they were on the campaign trail. You know, but here's the issue, Charles. You mentioned Winston Churchill. One of the most interesting insights about Winston Churchill was made by William Manchester, one of the greatest of his biographers. In the introduction to his great two volumes on Winston Churchill, William Manchester said that the specter of Adolf Hitler was such a threat that only someone who understood evil at its core would be equal to that response. The only person who would be able to confront Hitler and have any hope of besting him would be someone who understood the true nature of evil and was willing to confront it. And I love the statement. I think of it so many times. William Manchester describes exactly the man who would be needed. And then the next line says, in London, there was such a man. And there was Winston Churchill. And you take Winston Churchill out of history, and in especially from a providential understanding of history, it's hard to understand how you end up with World War II as we now remember it. But when we were looking at Adolf Hitler, you know, it's interesting. Many Americans would be, I think, embarrassed to go back and see the language used by our own leaders, people like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, people like Harry Truman, Dwight David Eisenhower, and others in statements about Adolf Hitler, statements about the Nazi regime. There was a very undeniable, unembarrassed use of the word evil. It was the only word that fit. And that does not compare well to where we are today. In terms of a reticence to use the word evil. That's what I think makes today's conversation so important. The New York Times today has this article by a Russian novelist, I quote in my article, Sergei Kanetsov, who says, evil exists and horror is always right beside you. I wonder if the New York Times is more comfortable writing about that when the story is localized in Moscow than when it's in New York. It's going to be very, very interesting to see, even with the terror trials coming up here in the United States, or at least a matter of controversy about whether they will be held even in a city like New York. It's going to be very interesting to see how Americans maintain a moral focus in the midst of this. You know, Charles, I'll tell you, I think you're exactly right. It's going to take enormous fortitude to face this. It always has. That was true going all the way back in world history to when terrorism first arose. And by the way, that was well before the age of the church. I mean, after all, you had the movements known as the Sicarii, and others who were operating even in the Middle East during the time, in the Near East, during the time of first century Judaism. The Roman Empire was threatened by terrorism. Virtually every regime throughout history has been threatened by terrorism. But this new modern war on terror seems to arise at a time when many people simply do not have a moral vocabulary that is adequate for the discussion. Let's think about how we should think about this. My argument that is made in my article published today at albertmuller.com is that Christians should not think that evil is something that is just, as this novelist said, right beside us. According to the scripture, evil is closer than that. It is within us. It beats within the human heart. And that's where we need to focus our discussion. Let me ask you, how do you explain evil? When your children ask you, what do these things mean? What are you telling them? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are discussing the reality of evil in an age that seems to lack much moral understanding or even an adequate moral vocabulary. But when we see something like the terror attacks there in Moscow, two female terror attacks, terror bombers, we should say, suicide bombers, who went inside highly populated subway stations in Moscow and blew themselves and at least 38 other people to their deaths, it's a reminder to us that we can't get through a day without an understanding of the difference between good and evil. It's a part of what is necessary to us, not only for human life and human flourishing and human survival, but I think is necessary for understanding of what it means to be human, is to know the difference between good and evil. Christians must know that this is our territory. This is where we have to go all the way back to creation and to the knowledge of God that is implanted within us, what it means to be made in the image of God, and what it means, of course, to be morally responsible. And a part of what it means to be morally responsible is to be able to speak intelligently and biblically about evil. Let's go to Todd, calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Todd.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mohler. You may be familiar with this book. It's called The Nazi Doctors, and it was a phenomenal read. And that, coupled with, if you're familiar with the Milgram experiment, and in the book, The Nazi Doctors, he had one amazing quote when he was interviewing the people that took place and took part of the Holocaust and genocide. He said, what was demonic is that these people were not demonic. And in sum, what you can say is that there were three basic criteria to meet for the most heinous evil to be committed. That was, one, the act was legal. Two, some perceived good would come out of it. And finally, there was someone else to blame, because the Nazi doctors, you know, they weren't abused children. They weren't monsters. They just were normal people that were committing evil acts under these three circumstances. And you think how easy that those could come, those could surface again.
Yeah, Todd, thank you so much for your call. Several things come to my mind based upon your call. Number one, you mentioned the Milgram experiments. That goes back in the United States to experiments done with male college students, discovering that under the right circumstances, even the most highly educated, highly cultured among us would do things that would be unthinkable as you increase the opportunity and lower the moral boundaries. Getting to the Nazi doctors, that is absolutely fascinating. And not just the Nazi doctors, but all those involved in everything from the killing squads and the SS to the infrastructure of the Holocaust and all the rest. You know, the really frightening thing about that, Todd, is that just as one German ethicist put it, these were men, by and large, and women, who were good to their children and kind to their pets, but they had no problem doing the most heinous and horrible atrocities imaginable because they had cauterized their consciences. One of the things we learned about the Nazi medical regime and the medical experiments, the Nazi doctors, as you mentioned, and the entire complex of National Socialism, is that we have a capacity as human beings to rationalize evil as something else, to declare it as good, to say that it is in some kind of instrumental purpose, that indeed some good will come out of this. We can fool ourselves. That's one of the most frightening realizations, is that the ultimate way we fool ourselves is by rationalizing our moral misbehavior as something other than what it is. You know, you also look at this and realize that worldviews do matter. And when you have a worldview that purposefully confuses the categories, you're leading not only yourself but many others into disaster. That's exactly what National Socialism did. That's exactly what George Orwell was writing about in his great novel 1984. And that's exactly what we see in an age in which we have such moral confusion, even now, where there are some, and I'm thinking in particular of some of those teaching in college and university campuses, who are suggesting that there just is no way you can use a word like evil in today's world, that it's indeed just not possible in a morally relative world to use that kind of moral clarity. I'm going to argue that it's indispensable. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll come back to more calls, and I'm glad to hear from you, of course, by email. Write us at mail@albertmohler.com. My article published today at albertmohler.com is entitled Evil Exists, Terror in Moscow. And one of the points I make in my article as you come to the end is that the Bible reminds us that evil resides in the human heart, not just in the Caucasus region, not just in Chechnya or Moscow or wherever the news may locate it. We are the people who better know that the evil that is our greatest threat is that which resides right in our own hearts. Evil is far closer to us than we often allow ourselves to remember. One of the most insidious aspects of evil is its ability to insinuate itself within us so silently until it bursts forth in the form of a black widow assault or a child abuser, or you name it. You know, the worry in Russia is that these attacks may be a harbinger of things to come. As we know from the human heart, this goes all the way back to Genesis 3. Back with more, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. To join the discussion, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, one aspect of this story coming out of Russia that certainly has a lot of attention is one that has been brought to my attention by several of you who have written in at albertmueller.com and called in to say, how do we explain the use of women as suicide bombers? What does it tell us that it has now come to this? I think tracing the history is rather important here. The recent use of female suicide bombers goes back to 1985, when a 16-year-old Palestinian girl drove a truck into an Israeli army convoy. I was reminded by the New York Times that Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi was killed in 1991 by a female terrorist, a member of a female squad known as the Birds of Paradise, associated with the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka. Back in the early part of this decade, there was a spate of what were known as black widow attacks, terror attacks by women in Russia, and especially in Moscow, 16 different bombings, including two onboard planes. And what's really interesting, in the New York Times, Andrew Kramer writes about this. I'm going to read to you exactly what it says here. It says, earlier this decade, Moscow's fear of female suicide bombers was so strong it became a lurid obsession. Women, sometimes casually clad in jeans and blending into the swirl of Moscow, committed at least 16 of these bombings. The attacks came early, as when a widow killed herself and the Russian commander who had killed her husband in one of the first such attacks in the Chechen War. It sometimes happened in the most unlikely places, like mingling in line at a music festival, which only multiplied the horror. Women joined in some of the most celebrated terrorist attacks in recent Russian history at a theater in Moscow and at a school in Beslan, Russia. You know, the reality is that the use of women as suicide bombers, or terrorists in this situation, is not only a tactical move, it certainly is also highly symbolic. And I think that's something we ought to take note of here, because the use of women in this situation is a sign that you can't trust anyone. That is the terror ambition here, is to make very clear that terror can strike anywhere, it can strike you, it can strike your loved ones, and you cannot tell from whence it's coming. It doesn't necessarily come for someone who looks like a terrorist, and in this case, these women who were wearing jeans and blending in to the rest of Moscow and the Moscow scene, they became very adept at these suicide bombings and scared the people of Moscow, as it said here, because they simply did not know where it was coming next, and that's a part of it. The dehumanization is very much a part of the agenda of evil, dehumanizing us and breaking down all of our moral understandings. That's what terror is all about, and terror was one of the favorite actions and tools in the arsenal of the anarchists in the early 20th century. And the anarchists sought to use terror in order to break down the entire structure of civilization. And you can see why it would work that way, because if we can't trust the person we're standing next to in a subway station or in an airport or sitting next to on a plane, then we're going to live with the constant suspicion that breaks down the kind of social order and social cohesion that makes civilization possible. And that's why we need to understand from a Christian perspective that evil is never as simple as it looks. It's never just one isolated little attack. It's never just one isolated and discreet little conspiracy. You see, from a Christian perspective, we have to understand that evil lurks in every single human heart. It's not some kind of commodity that is just dipped into by certain people in certain places at certain times under certain situations. Evil is so close to us because we come to understand that there's deep evil in the human heart. As the prophet said, the heart is desperately wicked. Who can understand it? And it emerges, yes, in these Black Widow suicide bombers in Moscow. It emerges in, you know, an adolescent shooter in an American school. It emerges with a single act of child abuse or pornography. It emerges when there's a single larcenous act, a single lie that is told, or it can be writ large in the kind of wide-scale terror attack that we knew on September the 11th, 2001, and in so many other situations. It can come in national form, as in the structure of Nazi Germany. It can come in a worldwide movement form. It can come in so many different kinds of forms, and it can come insidiously. And, of course, one of evil's chief agendas is to hide itself as something other than evil. You know, Hannah Arendt, the Jewish philosopher, was speaking of the trial of Adolf Eichmann, and she uttered one of the most iconic statements of the 20th century when she spoke about the banality of evil. And she referred to Eichmann, who looked, as she said, just like any kind of accountant, who was one of the most evil men of the 20th century in terms of the scale of his crimes, crimes against humanity leading to the murder of millions of Jews. And she said, we would have thought, you would have thought, that if you were looking at someone of that of that quantity of evil action, he would look sinister, but he didn't look sinister. He looked absolutely innocuous, and that's dangerous. But, you know, it's not just the banality of evil, it is the lure of it. And that's a part of the real problem here, is that evil can appear to be something very seductive and something powerful, and it can disguise itself even as something beautiful. That leads to the question, why would these women do these things? Why would these women blow themselves up? Why would they intentionally go into a subway to kill millions or thousands or hundreds or dozens of others? Why? Why would this happen? Michelle Tsai, writing at Slate.com on the explainer column, explaining why these women might do this and what rewards they might expect. She writes, in the Islamic background, that, as you know, men suicide bombers are promised supposedly some dozens, perhaps even 72 black-eyed virgins. Women are promised no such thing in the Quran or in Islamic teaching, but they are promised that they will live with their husbands without jealousy. Who knows exactly what was behind them, but I'll tell you what is interesting is the press coverage indicating that many of these women, young and old, are doing this out of resentments and out of a sense of anger over the loss of a loved one. But what we're looking at here is the reality that there is nothing that can justify this or satisfy the demand for its rationalization. But if you get yourself in a certain situation, evil is so close at hand. If you give yourself to it, this is the inevitable result. Let's go to Bill, listening on WHIM in Orlando, Florida. Go ahead, Bill.
First, Dr. Moore, it's a privilege to be able to talk to you, and I'm glad you're dealing with this issue. And I was just thinking about the prophet over in the book of Isaiah, as the Lord showed him a glimpse. And he says, woe is me, for I'm undone. And not only himself, but even the people around him. And I just want to say that if you take a person and take them out of the environment, it does not matter, because that person's heart would change that whole environment. So, again, you know, I talk to a lot of people, and they tend to think that, you know, well, there's a lot of good. We don't know what we would do except it be by the grace of God. So I just want to say to you, evil is on the inside, and that's why Christ died for us.
Bill, what a tremendously biblical statement you just made. And you got, of course, that most important part, which is the only solution to evil is one that we can't bring about. And only Christ can. Back with more on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. I was struck by the images coming from Russia, the photographs, the video. It's the kind of carnage we come to expect from major calculated terror attacks. And yet, even in the year 2010, there's just something deeply shocking about the sight of female suicide bombers. And the film and the video coming from Russia is just a reminder to us that it doesn't just happen in Moscow. These kinds of attacks can happen anywhere, and they do. And that's just a reminder to us of the universality of human evil. And even as some folks are looking at this, trying to figure out how we come to terms with the reality of evil, Christians are those who know that evil resides in the human heart, that evil begins in a conspiracy to rob God of his glory, and it began with a human conspiracy that involved two human beings in a garden. who conspired to rob God of his glory, to disobey God's law, and to eat of the tree that was forbidden, the fruit that was forbidden, and thus in Adam not only did he sin, but we all sinned. And that sin is now right there in our human hearts. And as it is so close to us, we need to realize that there but by the grace of God go I. Now, that isn't to say that we are living amongst people who are all around us just about to become suicide bombers. No, there is a process whereby there is a breakdown of the kind of moral reticence and the kind of moral protection that is around us. What we're looking at here is the reality that there are many people in this world who simply are determined to do evil, and they have reached certain threshold decisions, which is kind of like getting a weapon ready. They are weaponized human beings. And from a Christian perspective, we need to understand this. Just another reminder to us, not only of the comprehensiveness and the breadth of human evil, but the depth of human evil as well. I mentioned the statement made in the New York Times op-ed piece this morning by Sergei Kanetsov. It certainly caught my attention when he wrote about evil, that evil does exist and horror is always right beside you. When I read that, I thought, you know, that sounds so Russian. Sounds like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, but it's just as modern as the year 2010. He wrote on to say, as he concluded his article, "Tomorrow we will wake up and live with these truths, at least until we forget them again, as we have many times before." You know, the Russians may forget these things time and time again. Americans and Indians and the British and the French and people all over the world may forget these things again and again and again. But Christians, it better be the people who know that evil is never far from us. It is indeed in our own hearts. And that's why we so desperately need a resolution. We desperately need redemption. We desperately need not only the neutralization of evil, but a victory over evil, and that is accomplished only by Christ on his cross, and in human history it will only be accomplished when Christ brings all things under his judgment and the kingdom is fully at hand. Until then, evil is something we have to face, but we as Christians better know we're the ones who must face it honestly. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. Get ready with your call. Email your question. I'll meet you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.